I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the funk and frustration of wars without end, who knows how each chain of massive cruelty got started or how unwinnable battles come to an end. But we have at least this hour a linked framework of a 35-year story and its lessons from a man I read and respect. Andrew Bacevich got his military training at West Point and his history PhD from Princeton. He served as an army officer in Vietnam, then in Germany, later in the First Gulf War, and then he retired to teach international relations at Boston University and to write agonizing reappraisals of warfare and empire, like the book The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. In the Notre Dame Alumni magazine this summer, Professor Bacevich got it down to a plain-talking Letterman list of 10 lessons that he wants us to learn about why this endless war, is not working. But first he put a name to it, and here it is, America's War for the Greater Middle East, still with no end in sight. This fall, Andrew Bacevich is teaching a 7-week online course on what went wrong in the Middle East and why, and we're trying to fit a lot of it into one radio hour. Andy Bacevich, welcome back to the radio mic with us. We'll see how a framework can help here and why you made it a 35-year war from 1979 to 2014. Remind us of 79.
Well, I think the key point is simply this, that prior to 1979, the Islamic world was an afterthought in the eyes of the Pentagon. Beginning in 1980, it became a preoccupation. What happened in 79? The Shah of Iran was overthrown.
Our Shah,
and Iran went from being a so-called ally to being an adversary. And then in December of 1979, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. That action interpreted in Washington as the opening gambit of a broader Soviet effort to seize control of the Persian Gulf. Jimmy Carter responded to those dual crises in January of 1980 by declaring what was called the Carter Doctrine. And when he did that, he set in motion a militarization of U.S. policy in the Islamic world that has continued to the present day.
Americans being held hostage in Tehran, Jimmy Carter running for re-election. Here he is addressing Congress in 1980.
Let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force.
He didn't rule out nuclear weapons either. But what is the big change there in that speech?
Well, the big change is that from that point forward, the Pentagon began to focus on the requirements to wage a major war in the Islamic world. In other words, we create new commands. We reposition forces. We develop bases. We position supplies. We create new uniforms and new tactical methods in order to be prepared to intervene in the Islamic world. That's what began in 1980. And as those capabilities came into existence, what followed was a growing inclination on the part of presidents after Carter to put to use those forces, to attempt to use American military power to, you name it, dominate the region, transform the region, liberate the region, pacify the region, always informed by the expectation that the adroit use of American hard power could fix whatever was wrong in that region as far as Americans were concerned.
A new world map of American military commands, including CENTCOM over all the Middle East. You call it a loaded weapon pointed at the Persian Gulf. Explain how these things happen.
Well, going back to World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, the Pentagon had basically divided up the world into different areas of operations. Pacific Command, European Command, Southern Command, that related to Latin America. But there was never a command specifically focused on the Islamic world. One of the results of Carter declaring the Carter Doctrine was to see the emergence of that command, CENTCOM, United States Central Command. And I should mention more recently, we've got yet another command, U.S. Africa Command, which is also concerned with a considerable number of countries where the population is majority Muslim.
Speak of the Israel dimension here. Jimmy Carter has brought Sadat and Begin together, but Israel, it's clearer and clearer, is not just an ordinary client.
Well, I mean, this is a complicated and this is a sensitive story, but it seems pretty clear to me that as this war for the greater Middle East has evolved, and it hasn't evolved very successfully from a U.S. point of view, it becomes clearer and clearer that U.S. and Israeli interests simply do not align. I mean, I think a very good example of that has to do with the issue of the Palestinians. From the U.S. perspective, we have a profound interest in responding to the grievance of the Palestinians, to see the creation of a viable Palestinian state. Why? Because one of the claims made by many in the Islamic world is that their principal gripe against the United States is that we prevent the development of that Palestinian state. But frankly, if you look at that issue from an Israeli perspective, it looks a lot different. I don't think that the government of Israel has any particular interest in seeing the creation of a Palestinian state. The status quo, from an Israeli perspective, is really not all that bad. From an Israeli perspective, why should they take the risk of creating a Palestinian state? So Israel is one of, certainly not the only, a factor that affects U.S. policy in the Islamic world, but it is a complicating factor.
When did they signal that they were acting on their own?
When did the government of Israel signal that?
And it's still a question to this day.
They signaled they were acting on their own as early as 1948 and in successive periods. I mean, they signaled they were acting on their own when they defied the request of the Kennedy administration to not develop nuclear weapons and went ahead and decided to do that. Again, from an Israeli perspective, makes all the sense in the world. From the perspective of the United States, a very problematic development.
Meantime, Ronald Reagan succeeding Carter puts American boots on the ground in Lebanon. To what effect?
Well, Reagan succeeds Carter, but in a sense endorses, embraces, and affirms the Carter Doctrine and uses the Carter Doctrine as a basis to begin experimenting about how will we, in fact, use our power in this region in order to try to fix whatever is wrong. And during the Reagan administration, we've got skirmishes with Colonel Gaddafi's Libya. We've got peacekeepers going into Beirut. We've got indirect support for Iraq in its war against Iran. Relatively small-scale operations, but in retrospect, from my point of view, all of them yielding less than successful outcomes.
There's another big watershed when Iraq invades Kuwait in 1990. I mean, put that, you know, in the timeline here.
Well, Saddam Hussein had been our quote unquote friend. In August of 1990, he invades Kuwait. Overnight, he becomes our enemy. George Herbert Walker Bush. This is now the most direct attack on the Persian Gulf, the biggest threat yet to control of the Persian Gulf. And George Herbert Walker Bush mobilizes an army of over 500,000, biggest military undertaking since Vietnam, in order to throw Iraqi forces out of Kuwait, proclaims it a great victory, proclaims that it's going to result in a world transformed, and yields...
Let's listen to him in Congress. George H.W. Bush.
Halfway around the world, we are engaged in a great struggle in the skies and on the seas and sands. We know why we're there. We are Americans, part of something larger than ourselves. What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve universal aspirations of mankind, peace and security, freedom, and the rule of law. Such is a world worthy of our struggle.
Was it or wasn't it a new world order,
Andrew Bacevich? Obviously wasn't. But, I mean, appreciate the context in which George Bush is making this speech. The Cold War is coming to an end. Clearly, the United States is the predominant military power in the entire world. And Bush is expressing very clearly this expectation that by wielding this hard power effectively, we are going to have a transformative impact, not simply on Kuwait, but on the entire region. And, of course, what results is something less than that. Back in 1991, in the immediate wake of Operation Desert Storm, we Americans thought that we had won a decisive and, indeed, historic victory.
He's still getting good reviews on that.
But in retrospect, it was a victory that yielded serial disappointments. Saddam Hussein managed to remain in power. As a consequence of that, Bush and his successor Bill Clinton decided to maintain large-scale U.S. forces garrisoning the Gulf in order to contain Iraq and Iran. The garrisoning of U.S. forces elicited a very hostile response by people in the Muslim world who viewed U.S. forces as occupiers. And in some senses, the clock started ticking that ultimately leads to 9/11.
And the militarization, for sure, has taken root.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating today, I think, here in 2014, that the American people take it for granted that there will be large-scale U.S. forces in the Islamic world and engaged in military operations in the Islamic world.
And a lot of it began right then, even in the first Gulf War. I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with Andrew Bacevich and his outline of American military policy and power seeming to run amok. There's an online course coming up, a Letterman list of lessons, and then some feedback. Andy Bacevich is a West Pointer who fought in Vietnam and the first Gulf War. He spent a lot of the last 20 years teaching and writing his own hard lessons. Pick up the story, Andy, with George W. Bush after the attacks on 9/11. Let's just hear again the bold words of Bush 43 in September 01.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen. It may include dramatic strikes visible on TV and covert operations, secret even in success. We will starve terrorists of funding, turn them one against another, drive them from place to place until there is no refuge or no rest. And we will pursue nations that provide aid or safe haven to terrorism. Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
George W. Bush in September 01, he laid it all out. We're going to have a long, 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 interminable war, but of course we're going to win it handily.
Well,
Andrew Bacevich.
After 9/11, America's war for the greater Middle East kicks into high gear. The stops are coming out. He does envision a long campaign. My view is that the preoccupation with Iraq reflected a belief in the inner circle of his administration that by knocking over Iraq, and they expected it to be an easy victory, that would basically kick down the door in the Middle East and other victories, other transformative change would necessarily follow. Of course, that was a major miscalculation, to put it mildly, because Iraq turned out to be something other than the easy victory they anticipated.
It sounds like pure Dick Cheney. We're going to give you TV wars, but we're also going to give you hidden wars that you just have to dream about, meaning...
Well, it's not Dick Cheney, but it's Donald Rumsfeld. It's Paul Wolfowitz. It's a cohort of people who viewed themselves as national security experts, who viewed themselves as masters of war, who believed that they understood how to wield this superior American power with the greatest effectiveness. And George W. Bush, I think, in many respects, was their instrument. But it's more than just Cheney, in my view.
And the Congress was applauding. That's the other part. And the media, for the most part, was on board.
Well, I think that in retrospect, what we can see is that there was a broader infatuation with American military power that went far beyond simply the inner circles of the Bush administration, far beyond the so-called neocons, that there were people who probably viewed themselves as liberals. There were people who viewed themselves as detached and objective journalists who fell for this notion of American military indomitability.
Why do we fall for it?
Well, because we misread the lessons of the end of the Cold War. We thought we won the Cold War. I think more accurately, the Soviets lost it. The end came about as a result of a Soviet collapse, not an American triumph. We misread the lessons of Operation Desert Storm in 1991, thinking that that was a demonstration of American military superiority, even though that war ended in many respects inconclusively.
Andy Bacevich, you, in your Notre Dame piece, you have a wonderfully concise list of 10 lessons that we have to learn, or else that we should have learned, that you've learned anyway. And they go from the center of gravity in war. There's a lot of your strategic training shows up here. The overestimation of technology, the political economy of war. It is a living, it's a way to make money for so many industries now. Also, you have sharp points about our regional allies, especially Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Israel, not the allies you'd choose in a fight. Go through them as cleanly as you can. We won't get them all.
Well, let me make a preliminary point. And the preliminary point is simply that if we take the argument that our military endeavors in the Islamic world since 1980 should be viewed as one, as a whole, we shouldn't be simply be looking for the lessons of Somalia or the lessons of Kosovo or the lesson of Afghanistan. We need to try to understand what we can learn from all that we mm-hmm. have attempted and all we have sacrificed and all that we have failed to achieve over the past 3.5 decades. So it's the big lessons that need to be learned. I think you mentioned center of gravity. Now, this is sort of a technical term. What center of gravity
it's
means—
It's fascinating. Go ahead.
It's a Clausewitzian term. And what Clausewitz is arguing is that in any war, there is a factor that can be identified upon which the war's outcome turns. Frequently, that factor is the enemy army. Destroy the enemy army and you win. It may be the enemy's capital. Capture the enemy's capital city, and you win. And I think in this struggle, in America's war for the greater Middle East, the center of gravity is the people of the Islamic world. This 1.4, 1.5 billion people whose views ultimately will determine the fate of that part of the world. And once you recognize, if you accept that that's the center of gravity, then you have to confront the fact that we, the United States as part of the West, face enormous difficulties. Why is that? Because we are not like them. Because we are the West. Because we represent, we Americans, whether we like it or not, represent the civilization and a culture whose relations to the Islamic world have basically centered on exploitation. Now, we may not think of ourselves as part of that civilization.
Going back to the Crusades, but most specifically the British Empire and the French empires.
Precisely. So that when we typically, on the eve of some intervention, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or trying to put together some sort of a coalition, to whom do we look first? Well, we look to our British cousins. We say, please join us in this campaign of liberation. Why? Because from our perspective, Anglo-American... That phrase conjures up images, memories of Churchill and Roosevelt, Americans and Brits arm in arm against the fascists. Well, guess what? In the Islamic world, Anglo-American may convey a somewhat different message. It doesn't convey a message of liberation. It conveys a message of exploitation or abuse.
Here come those oil thieves again. Speak about technology and something that's not working in this magical advantage the United States
well,
is proud of.
Well, a minute ago, you said, how did it come to be that there were these false expectations of what American military power was going to do? And I think part of the answer to the question has to do with the perception of the role of technology that evolved in the wake of the Cold War during the course of the 1990s. To put it in the simplest terms, the fascination with precision-guided munitions and the belief that advanced weapons technology could be harnessed in order to achieve what journalists were calling back around 2003 shock and awe, meaning sort of a quick technological
watch it go down
punch
the chimney
in the nose
bang, right.
is going to end the war quickly, cleanly, cheaply. And that has turned out to be largely false. I mean, not entirely false. I mean, in 2003, shock and awe got us to Baghdad. Shock and awe resulted in the rapid overthrow of Saddam Hussein. But shock and awe certainly did not produce conclusive political success, which has to be the purpose of any war.
Are we still doing it with the drone war, do you think?
Well, I think to some degree we're reverting to that. Why is that happening? My reading would be that President Obama, concluded that invading and occupying countries ain't such a good idea. It doesn't work. It doesn't produce the kind of success that we expected when we first went into Afghanistan or we went into Iraq back in 2003. So his administration they haven't called off the war for the greater Middle East, but they've begun to experiment with other techniques.
But are they having any better luck with it, do you think?
Not in my view, except that one could argue from a sort of a narrow American perspective that the costs imposed on the United States in continuing to wage this misguided military effort have been reduced by President Obama in comparison to what they were during the George W. Bush administration.
You dwell on strategy itself, Andy, as a separate point. What do you mean by that?
I don't think we've had one. I mean, looking at this enterprise as a whole, trying to find out what connects Beirut in 83 to Somalia in 93 to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, there has been no consistent, coherent sense of design of how American power is going to be oriented and integrated to achieve some larger purpose. Mm-hmm. That's what strategy is all about. There's been a tremendous amount of improvisation. There's been a lot of ad hocery, of reacting to some crisis, expecting that somehow the reaction is going to produce a positive outcome. And there, I think the contrast with the Cold War is instructive. We made many, many mistakes in the Cold War, but we did have a basis of strategy. It was called containment.
You say we bring the wrong history to the war, that we are still thinking in a World War II head. They, when they see us coming, are seeing here comes British exploitation again. Is there any joining of that, any resolution of that, any way out of that, our own deep mindsets?
Well, I mean, we Americans prefer a sanitized and romanticized history, not simply a sanitized history of the United States, but a romanticized history of the world, and for especially as it enters into our political discourse, this is a history that centers on World War II, and World War II as a story of triumph. Now, World War II was a tremendously important event, and thank God that the Western forces, helped not insignificantly by the Soviet Union, ultimately defeated the Third Reich. But that's not the story that's particularly relevant in understanding the predicament we find ourselves in our relations with the Islamic world. There, it seems to me, a far more relevant story is, as you suggested, the story of British imperialism. that somehow we've been snookered into supporting after the British Empire went into decline.
Speak of the problem of regional allies.
Well, I think that we've done a poor job of selecting them. I mean, I would argue that probably the four most important allies we have in this war for the greater Middle East are Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Israel, and probably throw Egypt into the mix. And I'm not sure that any of the four of them pursue interests that align with ours in significant ways. And indeed, I'd argue that all four of them behave in ways that are quite contrary to our interests. Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are some of the chief sponsors of jihadism. That's supposedly the adversary that we're trying to suppress so that we can bring some sort of order and stability to the world. So we've got some problematic allies on our hands.
Your friend and mine, Stephen Kinzer, has written a whole book to the point that, you know, if we were starting from scratch, better build our regional alliances around Iran, of all states, and Turkey.
Well, of course, we can't start over again. But I think the point is a good one, that we should be exploring the possibility of forging relationships with those two countries in particular that could well be far more useful and important to us than our relations with Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and so on.
Speak finally of the matter of religion. George Bush said, but then took it back, that this was a crusade. We say we're not at war with Islam. You refine the point, shall we say.
Well, I mean, I think that we can say that, our leaders can say that all they want to, and it doesn't really carry much weight in the Islamic world. My sense is that there are many Muslims who believe that we are engaged in a war with Islam. And to the extent that they do believe that, then religion is a central component of what this struggle is all about. We may, for very good reasons, wish that it were otherwise, but wishing doesn't make it so.
How do you change it? I mean, how do you change the alignment? Say, you guys...
I don't think it is changeable. I mean, my bottom line argument is that the war for the greater Middle East is a misguided enterprise, that we have not won it, we are not winning it, and we won't win it, even if we choose to continue this war for the next several decades. And therefore, there's a fundamental need to consider the possibility of an approach to the Islamic world that does not rest on the notion that the United States is going to use its military power to influence the region in ways favorable to our interests.
At the start of the Obama administration, we thought we were headed in your kind of direction. I wonder what happened. But I also wonder, who are you arguing with? Who's arguing back? No, we are winning. We've got to win it.
I don't know that anybody argues that we are winning, but I do think that people argue that we must win it. At the present moment, very recently, President Obama has been widely criticized, and not simply criticized by Republicans, for failing to demonstrate the sort of strength of leadership that supposedly is required. And in Washington, when people talk about presidents leading, I mean, whether they will admit it or not, what they really are saying is they want to see more muscle flexing on the part of the United States. But muscle flexing is not producing positive results.
That's a lot of the spirit of the commentariat and certainly the Republicans in opposition. But at the same time, there's a general dismay, is there not, about where we're at, this endless, unwinnable war, just that we can't seem to shake.
Well, I mean, there's a public, I don't know if dismay is the right term, but there is a public reluctance to intervene that politically inhibits the president, even if the president were inclined to, send U.S. troops into Syria, which he's not inclined to do.
But it was the people who said, no, don't. He was on the verge.
When he drew his famous red line, right, and the Assad regime crossed it by using chemical weapons, I think you're exactly right. The American people said, hell no. The British Parliament, surprisingly, said, hell no.
The Pope said no.
And the president found himself having made a threat that he was not politically in a position to follow through on.
And the UN and the EU and almost anybody you could put your finger at said, no, don't do it. I mean, who's to say that he's in deep trouble for not following, you know, the military lead?
Well, he's in deep trouble if you look at, I mean, if you attribute importance to his popularity ratings, he's in deep trouble.
You may be right. Andy Bassett, this gets more interesting. Coming up, we're going to look at the Bassett frame and how it looks to others in the field, starting with Melanie McAllister, who writes about culture and empire in the Middle East and teaches at George Washington University in D.C. And also in our studio, Hugh Roberts, with long experience with the International Crisis Group in North Africa. He teaches Middle East history at Tufts University. But first, under the heading of What Are We Learning?, here is President Obama to the United Nations.
To summarize, the United States has a hard-earned humility when it comes to our ability to determine events inside other countries. You know, the notion of American empire may be useful propaganda, but it isn't borne out by America's current policy or by public opinion. Indeed, as recent debates within the United States over Syria clearly showed, the danger for the world is not an America that is too eager to immerse itself in the affairs of other countries or to take on every problem in the region as its own. The danger for the world is that the United States, after a decade of war, rightly concerned about issues back home, aware of the hostility that our engagement in the region has engendered throughout the Muslim world, may disengage, creating a vacuum of leadership that no other nation is ready to fill.
Melanie McAllister at George Washington, do you want to tweak Andy Bacevich's basic 35-year framework?
If I was to tweet it?
Tweak it. Then you tweet it.
I was like, I can't do that in 140 characters.
Nice try.
Well, so hi, Andy. And I want to say first that the things I appreciate so much about this are the critique of the failed assumptions that political problems have military solutions, or the idea that there are so few limits to what we can solve that the U.S. should try to go out and save the world, which somehow surely views us as a savior. I think this is all really important to critique. And I guess I have a couple of things I want to ask about. One is, I want to ask about Islam and Israel. So let me start with Islam, because it's really more of a tweaking, which is, as you know, Andy, you know, 62% of the world's Muslims live in South and Southeast Asia, not in the Middle East. Only 20% of Muslims in the world live in Arab countries. Now, I know you're talking about the greater Middle East, which I guess then allows us to include Pakistan and Afghanistan, but we really are talking about a set of interests that the United States sees itself as having in the Middle East or even in the greater Middle East, which I would argue has very little to do with it being an Islamic world. There may be people in the Muslim world who see the U.S. as being at war with Islam and have some good reasons for that. But I would ask on the other end is, why would you say the U.S. is at war with the Islamic world when Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country, India, the third largest, Pakistan just right in between, when many of the most important Muslim countries have nothing to do with this? So why pull religion in? And I think in some ways sort of give credence to the idea that this is a clash of civilizations in which religion is the key player, when I don't think that's what's at stake.
Andy Bacevich.
Well, I don't mean to be pulling religion in. I think religion is in regardless of whether we do the pulling. I mean, my basic argument in this regard is that we've heard presidents, and not simply George W. Bush, but I think both his predecessor and his successor, say, we've got no gripe with Islam. And they may well mean that. But I have my doubts that that actually carries all that much weight with the people who we are trying to influence in Pakistan or in Saudi Arabia or in Iran or in Iraq. So it's not to make an argument that says, yes, let's go wage war against religion. Rather, it's an argument that says, it seems to me that we have to acknowledge that there is a religious component to this struggle, and that that is a source of great, it complicates things tremendously.
Melanie, you said you had a point about Israel, too.
Well, yeah, I think that this is, I just want to say that I'm not suggesting, Andy's bringing, you're bringing religion in where it doesn't exist. I just think that when we describe what's going on in terms of U.S. interest, I don't think you as the greater Middle East is the Islamic world, right? So U.S. interests are in the Middle East. There are non-Muslims there, and there's a lot of Muslims elsewhere. So I think it's just a way of thinking about when we talk about religion as the key interest, which is not to say that people don't think religion matters, which obviously they do. In terms of Israel, I think the question that you raised, the thing that you said about how Israel is not a great ally for the U.S. in certain ways, that Israel's interests are divergent from what the U.S. needs, makes a lot of sense. And yet I also think there are very good reasons why the U.S. has considered Israel as its ally. By good reasons, I mean that the Israelis have backed up American military expansion, the kind of a military expansion that you're critiquing. Israel has been a strong backer of that. And so in that sense, the U.S. has turned to Israel as a partner in crime, so to speak.
Hugh Roberts, weigh in.
Okay, let me just pick up this thing about religion. I mean, clearly Melanie is right that a large part of the Islamic world is not in the firing line, hasn't been. I still think that Andy's got a big point about religion being a key element in the 35-year war that's been going on. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that it seems to me that actually the Western and American position in this war has, at any rate, been very, very far from clear to onlookers. I think there's been a great deal of muddle in what actually the principles are that America has been at least notionally asserting. When we hear George, the first President Bush, saying, "We know why we are here," and we later on hear Andy saying, I think very, very cogently, that actually there's been a lack of clarity about the actual purpose of this war throughout. There's been a series of campaigns in a kind of one damn thing after another, without there being a clearly articulated overarching purpose or design that anyone can grasp and see and respect as being founded on some sort of principle. When, for instance, we see the Carter Doctrine clearly articulating an essentially conservative attitude to the defense of the status quo in the Persian Gulf. But we see then American rhetoric in relation to these wars asserting a transformative dynamic or purpose. Which is it? It seems to me that there has been it's been extremely difficult for onlookers, particularly those on the hard end of the bombings, to understand what is going on here. And a natural tendency, therefore, to react in terms of identity. And the wounds of identity, that identity being Islamic, even if it doesn't actually mean that all Muslims are.
Hugh, let me ask, what do you make of Andy's point about the center of gravity here in the people? Well, it's quite unlike the Cold War, say. It sounds like sort of hearts and minds all over again. How do we engage with those people if the premise is right?
Well, there was a hearts and minds element to the Cold War. And one of the things I think that why, if the West didn't win, the communists lost, was that America in particular and the West in general demonstrated a model of society and of political organization that was attractive to the populations in the Soviet world. They began to yearn for the freedoms and the economic living conditions and so on, but the political freedoms and intellectual freedoms that they saw demonstrated in the West. And I think this has been a major problem in the American position in the Middle East, in the greater Middle East. It has not been demonstrating either a social model or a political model that is attractive to people with any conviction. And let me explain this a little bit more, because I think that religion is by no means the only point at issue, but ideology in general certainly has been at issue. Take the American rhetoric about the transformative aspect, particularly a rhetoric associated with the 2003 war in Iraq, that this was going to kick the door open and permit a democratic transformation of the Middle East, which of course has not happened. Consider what America did a year ago in basically going along with the Egyptian army's coup against the first ever democratically elected president in Egypt. There's been a complete incoherence in the American position where grand principles are concerned. And I think that there, as a result, it's been impossible for the people in the Middle East to be in any way responsive to the hearts and minds aspect of the American position, which has been basically threadbare. And so I very much agree that the people are the center of gravity, and it seems to me a fundamental point about the American position over the last 35 years has been the, if you like, the moral hollowness of its stance and position as something that it is putting to the peoples of the Middle East as something that they might respond to positively, particularly in relation to the universal principles of democracy and rule of law.
And you don't see, you can see that so clearly going on right now in Gaza, where the U.S. is not taking a stance and really going to look bad as a result.
I can't endorse this point too strongly. It seems to me that America as exemplar, America as model, that provides the basis for an alternative, a strategic alternative to open-ended war, beginning with the assumption that perhaps military power is not our strong suit. Perhaps our strong suit, if we could actually live consistently with our values.
That's the consensus in this conversation. I would also throw it out optimistically that it was the lesson of a year ago when the president was ready to swat Syria for all it was worth. And the people said, no, we read it in the papers on television. We see in this misery in Gaza. Who in the world believes in military solutions to these problems anymore, except the guys in the Pentagon and the Pentagons around the world? What's the way back to the public wisdom, not to mention the lessons of history on this
point?
Well,
I wish I could give you a good answer to that excellent question. I mean, but you're touching on the fact that, and I also mentioned this as one of the lessons in that Notre Dame magazine article, we are saddled with a national security bureaucracy that is so immense and is so uncreative and is so in the habit of responding to problems in a predictable way that it's very difficult, I think, within the policy community for strategic alternatives to actually receive any sort of an honest hearing. And so policy ends up being, in essence, let's keep trying harder. If invasion doesn't work, let's try drones. And that's a pretty sterile approach to policy.
You write in the piece, Chuck Hagel's personal staff in the Pentagon is 2,500 well-paid, smart people. I mean, it gets absurd. Do they read the Notre Dame magazine, I hope?
I doubt it.
Melanie, seriously, I mean, this is the only question, is how to bring sort of common sense, the lessons of experience, and a popular feeling to 2,500 guys in the Secretary of Defense's office.
Well, but I'm going to come back to some of Andy's other work where I think we have to be even more cynical than this crowd has managed so far, which is that the U.S. public may not want to go to war in a number of different cases, where Syria being one, but the U.S. public is extremely militaristic in their enthusiasm for the almost unlimited budgets offered to the Pentagon and the, you know, basically civil religion of worship of the military. And I'll just mention briefly, I teach a course called U.S. Middle East Cultural Encounters. And 10 years ago, all anybody wanted to talk about was Israel-Palestine. Now all anybody wants to talk about is, you know, the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. But nobody can speak about it freely if there are vets in the room, which there almost always are, because they are presumed to have all wisdom and knowledge. Even when they try to say, actually, I just, you know, I didn't. I just went to war and came home. The ways that we have come to treat the military as a kind of sacrosanct institution to the degree that one can't even criticize military policy without doing a lot of worshipful rituals is very, very striking. And I think it does say that there's a limit to that public wisdom when it comes to actually putting some limits on
any basic
military budget.
You're a vet. You teach vets. How do you handle it? You gave us rough a report card on the Tommy Franks generation of generals, as I can imagine. There are no patents in this man's army anymore. I mean, when do they learn? How do you teach it?
Melanie's put your finger on an exceedingly important point, that it's very difficult to wean the American people away from these myths of American military superiority and to get Americans to think seriously and critically about what military power can do, what it can't do, how much it's going to cost, what are the risks involved. And this is another one of these issues that I just don't have a solution to, but it further complicates the whole picture.
Strange that that respect survives all this bad news. Not one big victory since, call it H.W. Bush's in Gulf One. Hugh, lead us to the light here.
Well, I'm an outsider, but it seems to me that one of the many merits of what Andy's been saying and writing is he puts his finger on a particularly important point. The transition from a citizen army to a volunteer professional army, I think that's been a major factor that has tended not simply to insulate the military from criticism, but to insulate the civilian political class from a sense of having any responsibilities in respect of these matters. I think that if congressmen were receiving letters from the parents of drafted servicemen, that would be a countervailing pressure to the military establishment that would energize the political class in America. I think that how you get back from that, we have a comparable problem in Britain. The decision to abandon national service and have an entirely professional army has had a comparable consequence, except that, of course, Britain is less energetic in the military sphere than America. But I would like to just broaden that a little, because it seems to me that in making that point, Andy has actually instanced one of a number of things that one could and needs to bear in mind. The extent to which this war has actually had collateral damage on America's own public life and on the actual character of the American political system. It's had, it seems to me, a corrupting and eroding effect on America's own political values as a democratic republic ruled by law. We've seen something similar also in Britain and France. I just make a point for the record. Andy talks exclusively about the US, but of course there have been these other arguably awkward allies in the Western capitals. Take the Libyan adventure that was, if anything, promoted by London and Paris. The point is that there has been this political price at home in terms of the character of public life, and I think that's something that might have traction with American public opinion if it was put to them.
Andy makes that point about the privatization, the outsourcing of all this war contracting, too. That's corrupting in its own way. Class is dismissed with all sorts of thanks to Andrew Bacevich for giving us his radio course on the war for the greater Middle East. There are links to his class and his syllabus on our website, as well as an interactive timeline. Thanks also, Hugh Roberts and Melanie McAllister. Please visit us at radioopensource.org, where there are loads of other conversations going on, too. Next week, the war that poisoned a century. That was the Great War. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Kunal Jasti, who leaves us to return to school at Columbia University. George Hicks engineered the program. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.